Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive, and we are waiting. I'm just signing in lately. I hope you're listening. We have with us Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam, who is coming to us from Selma, Alabama. We were not on the air yesterday. It was not our own fault. We didn't have any power to our broadcast. So we had some technical problems. You all bear with us. We are working on this. We don't have an assistant. We have people, you know, we have brother who's helping us out. We don't have a technical person that runs the board, so it kind of creates some problems for us. So we are hoping that you would bear with us and be patient with us and work with us. You know that you can, we may benefit. We have with us, our brother is here. He's faithful. He is a man that has gone into a town and become a pioneer. I think when he came to Selma, Alabama, there weren't any Muslims in Selma to count. They didn't even have a center. But he went into town and he saw that the message of Islam is about community. He saw that the message of Christianity is about community. So he went to work. Put his hammer together, put his saw together. And it wouldn't shock me to be invited to the state of Alabama and be invited to come and campaign for him to be the governor of that great state, or the United States Senator for that great state. I believe that America is shifting. I believe America is now ready for new leadership. I think Mr. Trump may disagree with me, but he's a sign of discontent in the body politics. I know what Satan is trying to do, but I'm talking about what God is stirring in the people. And Satan always throws his hand first. And I told a Caucasian from Gainesville, Georgia, on the train. We rode from New York to the Newark Airport for about 40 minutes. And 40 minutes, I left him. He was pumping his fist at me and an appreciation. He'd gone from a Donald Trump supporter to a doubter. I'm convinced that God has given us the message that is heavy, and God says that he will soon give you a message that you are well pleased, give you that which we are well pleased. We have to work the message. We were out on the streets of Linden, New Jersey, Roselle, New Jersey, passing out flyers for our meeting that we're going to be having on Sunday. It's going to be at 710 West St. George Avenue. I was telling the preacher, I said, well, Reverend, I didn't grow up as a Methodist, but I'm going to use some of the Methodist strategies. What are the Methodist strategies? They went on a circuit. So we're starting, charity starts at home and spread abroad. We're going to hold our first meeting in the hometown that I live in, Linden, New Jersey, where a terrorist was shot right in that town, not far away from where I live at. So I thought that was a powerful sign. And we're going to be at 710 West St. George Avenue for a men's meeting. And the men's meeting will be our host of men's meeting, taking charge of our responsibility to our community. November 6, 2016, at 1 p.m. 2016, at the Entrepreneur and Business Center, 710 West St. George Avenue. We're also going to be urging and pushing people to fulfill Fannie Lou Hamer's vision of voting. Fannie Lou Hamer was almost killed in Ruleville, Mississippi. A kidney was damaged because she decided to vote. We ain't going to sit down. We're going to vote. If we had the resources, we would go on every doorstep and make sure that our whole people vote. There's enough people in Georgia to take the candidate of whomever you support over the top. I'm not going to. spend that much time on that, because I guess it's he's a political expert. So I'm going to talk with him, and I'm not going to shut up. But remember, 710 West St. George Avenue is the beginning of a campaign to have an urban peace in our neighborhood. I asked the African-American community people, I said, what do you fear the most? They didn't tell me the police. They feared us. And I believe that, as the scripture says, the judgment started at my house. Now, I know it's talking about the church. It's also talking about the mosque. But real judgment starts at our own self. Because one day, each and every one of us will be rolled up and brought before the judgment bar and asked to be held accountable. So y'all can tell that I'm in a preaching mode. I'm going to restrain myself and ask our brother, an expert on politics and spiritual matters, named, born and raised with the name Joseph, Yusuf, same name. So Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam of Selma, Alabama, welcome to Religion Means Alive, and what do you say today, November the 5th, 2016, 3 days before the election?
Let me just say to you, Brother Imam, and to your listening audience, it's very important that we greet them with peace, but let me just say we're so appreciative at your effort to labor to bring about more excellent human life. And we hope and pray that that event, I think you said on West Jordan, is
West St. George Avenue.
George, yes. I hope it's successful, and I'm sure all the people under the sound of my voice are wishing you the best return on your efforts. So it's good to be here, and I just plug into New York Times today on my cell phone, and they have a great irony budding where one of the candidates called the immigrants rapists and all kind of things. And the objective political data is tending to indicate that there is a massive swell of voters from this group of rapists, such a big tidal wave that now they're saying that Senator Clinton has an upsurge in all these states where these Latinos and Hispanics are coming out like gangbusters. And it would be ironic if they drive the nail home in terms of a defeat for Donald Trump. No group of human beings, no group, Caucasian, Jews, whoever, no group should be stigmatized as being problematic across the board when the Creator created the sons and daughters of Adam in the most excellent mode. So Trump was wrong in characterizing those people that way. And it may be that the chickens are getting ready to come home to roost politically.
I think that the Latinos who are now unified, it even seemed that the Latinos, even the Cubans, have decided to come as a Latino bloc. They've forgotten being Puerto Rican. They've forgotten being the Cubans. They've forgotten being anybody else that did the Latino bloc. They said you have besmirched. One lady who was, I think she was seen to be, she's a Republican, a George Bush type Republican, absolutely said she was not going to vote for Mr. Trump. I think Mr. Trump is going to go into the dustbins of history as a disgraced figure. And I believe that America, the great, better, the angels are protecting America from the likes of him, and it would seem to me that he's not even interested in voting, winning the election. He's interested in just being on a massive ego trip. I think we're going to defeat him. He's going to be defeated. And I think that we're going to be highly successful. And I'm not here to endorse a candidate. You all know I'm voting. I'm going to be at the polls early. I certainly would tell you I'm not voting for Mr. Trump, that's for sure, because I believe that Mr. Trump is the actual personification of the worst of America. I don't think America is that. I think that African Americans should be at the polls in large numbers. I think that there's enough African Americans in Georgia that are asleep. We got to stop. There shouldn't be any excuse for an African American not voting. There shouldn't be the zero excuse. And we have to have the spirit that the Latino brothers are having. And they are not going to allow you to besmirch them. I know that they don't all agree with Ms. Secretary Clinton. I know that they all don't agree, but they are not going to allow Mr. Trump to pull his Trump. And a brother said something to me, when you really think about Mr. Trump, you think of his last name, Trump, it tells us something, that his rump is out. It tells us that the Satan is making a big joke, and that's what I told this Caucasian from Gainesville, Georgia. I said, actually, the guys that don't dig you or I, they have manipulated to put him out there and to bring us, you and I, who are Native Americans, against each other. And I said, we can't forget, sir, that America, part of America, was once a part of the Latin, what you all call the Spics. I said, now, I don't call me. I'm sure you don't. Though I know he probably did. Now, he probably called me a few names, too. But I said, it's okay. We're healing. So we're going to reach first when we wake the African American up. Well, I'm going to shut up, brother, ma'am. I'm fired up. I've been out here teaching on the streets.
No problem, brother.
I want you to go. No, please restrain me, because, brother, somebody asked me, did I go to see the Birth of a Nation and Nate Parker's movie? I said, no, I'm not sane enough yet to do that. I don't know what I would do after I come out. I'm the grandson. I was talking to a big-time reporter yesterday, and he was really questioning me. I said, Virgie, Mae Desmond would have been on the 1st of November 116 years old. So my my grandmother, Lula Nallen, God bless her. I hope she's in the cosmos. She didn't appear to me. She wasn't a traditional believer in God. She more believed in conjuration and witchcraft. But that lady was a slave. And they said there's no barrier between the oppressed and God, whether they be pagans or not. And she had been a slave. And that drives me in my life. So I'm not sane enough yet to go and see my people brutalized. I went into a movie to see a movie one time, and I was sitting next to a Caucasian, and he was eating popcorn. I'm sure he was an innocent Caucasian. But I had to get up out of the movie because old Nat was in me, and a few others were in me. A few unresurrected slaves were in me, and I just left the theater. Brother said, why'd you leave? I said, brother, I couldn't take this. I couldn't see Mississippi burning as they beat that brother and brutalized him. I'm too fresh from the wound. I wonder if you can make a reflection on the plethora of movies that seem to have defeated us. And you went to see the movie The Birth of a Nation. Tell us, is there any connection between that movie and what's going on today?
I think when we look at the big picture, brother, ma'am, combination of reasons, but I think I always like to look toward grace and mercy. The African American people in general now are in a very comatose state. This is the wrong historical period for us to be in a comatose state. Many of us were sleeping on the cargo on the ship. If this wolf was right outside of our door growling. But for the grace of Allah, this wolf could have came in the house. And many of us would have been caught napping. Don't have a clue as to where we are in history and what kind of threat we had. So we're asleep. And I think the masked man is given to shock treatment. I saw that movie and I was studying my brothers and sisters. And I saw almost scientific shock therapy being applied. The images, the information that one had not been exposed to. The average person in the audience didn't know who Nat Turner was if he had been resurrected from the grave and hit him in the head with a brick. They didn't know anything about it. Our people really don't know a whole lot about our history. We go through a little facts of one of us invented the red light and the comb and Charles Drew with the plasma. These little baby facts during Black History Month, but having a deep knowledge of our history, that's simply not there. And I really believe that in this moment of global crisis, Allah, Almighty God, is allowing these movies to come out as a mercy to try to wake us up so that we can see what time it is. And I've seen two or three of them. One alone, no matter how traumatic and powerful, is not enough to shock us out of this comatose state. But the cumulative impact that I kind of was picking up on this last movie about Birth of a Nation, I think now this urge to come alive is getting ready to pop out of the unconscious and become a conscious energy, a conscious body of energy. When that happens, it's going to be a good time for all of us to work. So you get ready, brother, ma'am.
Yes, sir. I believe you're right. Tell us why any observation before we go to politics. I was wondering if you could share with us, what do you think caused certain elements in the cultural apparatus to first allow this movie to come out? And then, secondly, to attack Nate Parker, who was never found guilty of rape, and use him as a rape charge and even to besmirch Nat Turner's motives, as William Styron did. Would you share with us something about that?
Well, first of all, there are some brilliant African-American people behind the camera now. They're directors, they're producers. There's people with resources like Oprah and many others. There's more and more light being shown on our history. So these directors are being, this new breed, kind of taking Spike Lee up to another level. A lot more sophisticated, a lot more experience, learning from those who came before them both. I mean, Caucasian, Jewish, as well as African-American like Brother Spike Lee. They simply have the information and they have the creative skills. They've gone beyond the black pathological genre. I don't mean the black exploitation movies, but the Boys in the Hood. Singleton did a good job, and Menace to Society. Those kinds of movies. Those two brothers understood the raw edge street mind of the African American in a very, very big way. And they did a good job in depicting it. But now we have a new breed that can tell our story in a very skilled and productive way. The fact that you have some of us behind the scene like Oprah with a little money is not hurting. So I think that's why we see now such a outflowing of creativity in terms of this particular surge out of Hollywood. But Hollywood itself been on the salt for being allegedly discriminatory in their efforts to hamstring African-American independence, creativity, and initiative. Now, there were some people that there are some people that understand this creeping awakening that these movies can stimulate, and they quite frankly do not want to see this kind of reawakening of the souls of black folks. So I think they took a pot shot at Brother Parker, not so much to hit him, but to put a chill to suppress attendance at the movie. By the way, that particular strategy was not successful.
Yes. What do you make of the fact is that the brother was accused, some have even tied him to rape? Was that to let the American pass off the hook?
Well, again, as I suggested, there were some who probably did not want to see the movie. But as far as even discussing a charge, has already been resolved as a waste of time. That kind of doubling down is not allowed in our system of law, and so I won't even dignify that kind of thing. The bottom line, the young man was exonerated. So that's that with that. And we don't need to go any further.
And I agree. I think it was trying to besmirch and to disrupt history, the facts, that we didn't just take it laying down. And, I William Styron probably is stirring in hell somewhere with his book, The Confessions of Nat Turner. His daughter tried to defend him. I want to ask you to make a comment on that before I move to another subject.
Well, the history obviously was written to make it appear that there was some level of, let me put it this way, a lack of nobility on the efforts of Brother Turner. The victim history writes history the way the victor would like to write history. But they praying and Allah praying. The message in Nat Turner's life, even in the distortion of Caucasian presenters, has not been escaped, that this world's life was not successful in extricating the natural rules that God has put in a human being that suggests that oppression is worse than turmoil and slaughter. I doubt if Brother Turner had ever read that in the Quran, but that urge was clocked into his scripture. And so he responded in his nature to demonstrate that the picture was alive. And he acted on the natural concept that oppression is worse than turmoil and slaughter. Naturally, the oppressor does not want that very naturalized premise to be embraced by the slave. Of course not. We would be naive to expect anything different.
Let me turn our attention to the state of New Jersey, to the United States District Court for the District of Jersey, and the conviction that came out of Judge Layton's courtroom of two top deputies to Governor Christopher Christie. I'm not going to kick the governor while down, but I wanted to make a comment. The governor has made some friendly overtures toward me, and I appreciate it. But the government, United States government, won a conviction of two of his top deputies. According to the New York Times, the governor of the state of New Jersey even collided with the governor of New York to suppress the information surrounding the closing of the George Washington Bridge. I know you have been a defense attorney, been a prosecutor, been a law professor, and I know you to be a man of mercy and compassion, and you're not going to kick my state when my state is down. I've seen the state of Alabama and its judiciary ran through the mud, its governor ran through the mud. What can you tell my audience?
I tell your audience.
Can you comfort my audience as we see the two deputies to the governor of the state of New Jersey go down in smokes and prepare for the federal penitentiary to receive them?
Let me just say, of course, we never exult over misfortune and tragedy of any human being, no matter how wrongful and criminal their behavior. But the truth of the matter is, if you get a wrongdoer that starts singing like a shown-up bird, the way that insider David Wildstein did, that's Katie bought a dope. You can just about rest assured that there are going to be convictions. Strategically located in the drama, in the plot, in the scheme, and did not hesitate early on to sing like a super bird. So that's the key to that case, if you ask me. Now, there's been a lot made by, and I'm gonna say this, I'm not gonna hit the governor, other than saying this. There's been a lot made about the missteps of young prosecutor Mosby in Baltimore. But I question the decision that federal prosecutors made in this case not to go after the governor. I don't understand it. I'm not going to cast any aspersions based upon undue speculation and wanton conjecture. We're not going to do that. But if we just rely on simple mother wit, the governor of New Jersey was a sitting duck, and he was allowed to wobble away quacking with a defense of quackery. He should have been brought to account. The evidence and the goods are there. No further account. No further statement. Brother Imam, are you still on the air?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I had it on mute. Yes, sir. Mr. Fishman is a very careful prosecutor.
Too careful.
I don't know whether or not there's some ongoing investigations with Mr. Christie on other matters.
Well, I'm going to take judicial notice of the fact that they've had a close relationship in the past. And we can't deny it.
No, we can't. We can't deny that. But Mr. Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District, which is probably one of the most important court districts of the United States judicial system, is also seen to be circling Mr. the governor of the state of New York. So we don't know. I understand that. But, I mean, there's a lot of ongoing stuff going on with Mr. Fishman's office that we can't yet rule out with Mr. Christie. And it wouldn't shock me, certainly wouldn't surprise me, if Mr. Christie is yet to be indicted. I think so. There's some, you know, his brother. There's a lot of stuff going on.
That he's probably an unindicted co-conspirator.
What does that mean when you're an unindicted co-conspirator?
The thing speaks for itself. You were involved in the conspiracy, but you were not indicted.
So if you're an unindicted co-conspirator, at some point could you be indicted?
Unindicted co-conspirator. It's been a while since that issue came across my mind, but I don't think so. I really don't think so. That's why I made the point. You could be indicted on a collateral charge, but not, I don't think, on a basic and seminal charge.
Okay,
there was no
reason I asked, because I, you know, remember.
There was no need to seal this thing off and obscure the possible role of the governor. I mean, let's face it. Wildstein made his position clear from the beginning. It was straightforward, precise, and to the point. He's always indicated that the governor had a role to play.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, as we go into pre-sentence reports, and these two ladies, the lady is facing, she has four children, she's facing jail time. She didn't really indict, she didn't indicate that she still seems to have been saving the governor. And also, Mr. Peroni saved the governor. Under pressure of the federal prison system and being in jail with Homie, and Homette, and I'm just probably using the terms the FBI may use, is it possible then that these people may begin to talk a little bit more, to have some mitigating circumstances, and give the Fed something? I mean, we're in a transition now. There may be some information going on. Yeah.
My understanding during the trial that they made statements that implicated the defense attorneys implicated the governor to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But Ms. Kelly, is a hardship case. There's several counts, conviction. She's in a very peculiar situation with those four children. It wouldn't surprise me if the judge has discretion in sentencing that he's going to exercise leniency, mercy, compassion, and clemency in her case. And so if that happens out of fundamental fairness, you also must apply almost an equal measuring stick, not an equal, but almost. So Baroni may collaterally benefit from that factor. I could be wrong. I'm speculating. But the case projects a certain aura that maybe cries out for that kind of judicial discretion in sentencing.
Well, before I move on, I watched this Judge Layton and her sentencing patterns, and I must tell you, as a layman, I suspect very strongly the United States government takes great exceptions to people that they say waste the court's time with a trial when they could have pled guilty. So I think whatever her name is, and Mr. Barone had better start packing their bags and getting ready for the federal penitentiary. I'm going to predict 3 years in the federal prison and some other time. I think they're going to jail. I think that the United States government is very hard on people to go to trial. It seems to me, and I would ask you, well, what you know, just from what you know now, would you have urged your client to plead guilty if you had been their defense attorney, given what the government had?
Well, look at what Wildstein did. They should have ran like 90 going off from the beginning when they saw him make his move, in my opinion. Now, maybe that was all the prosecutor needed and was not open to any more maneuvering in that regard. But they should have maybe settled this thing. I agree. And I don't doubt your position on the judge. Every judge has his or her own peculiar personality and way of doing things. And obviously you know more about this particular judge than I do. So I defer to your assessment in this situation. After all, you're not a Neanderthal when it comes to legal understanding.
Well, I don't have the experience of being a law professor and being a prosecutor and being a defense attorney, but I have been around the bar. Perhaps, as one judge described me, as a person who perhaps been kicked around by the bar, and I've been around the bar as I represented myself, and I told the judge, that, Your Honor, I will plead guilty to malpractice for being represented myself, and Your Honor would give me leave of the court, I will now obtain counsel. Of course, this was not on a criminal matter. This was on a matter that was in the bankruptcy court, and I did this some 15 years ago, and I hurried up and got counsel because you know the adage, he who represents himself has a fool for a client. And I really think that those lawyers did that lady a disservice and was interested in billing hours, and they should have told her, look, the government got a strong case. You don't know what's going to happen at trial. I would recommend that you plead guilty and throw yourself on the mercy of the court. But anyway, we won't spend no more time on that. I think the governor, it wouldn't surprise to see the governor right in his own former district facing prosecution. Especially the way the political, and I think one of the things, I will now turn to Mr. Giuliani, that is the former mayor of the city of New York, and his statement, very arrogant statement, that he had influenced with the FBI and that he also, his law firm, one of his former law partners, Mr. Randy Mastro, billed the state of New Jersey for approximately $2.5 million to exonerate Mr. Governor Christopher Christie. Would you care to comment on that before we turn to the election campaign? We're going to have the rest of the
thing. A master exercise in magic in any report coming therefrom. What is his name? Repeat his name again.
To Rudy Giuliani.
No, the guy who did the report.
Randy Mastro from the Gibson Crutcher law firm. Yeah, I thought it was a $2 million colossal waste of government money. The state of New Jersey, our taxes are high enough, and I think to exonerate this man and lose cell phones, maybe he himself should be reported to the Bar Association. I think we as African Americans should stand for more justice. It seems to me that we're just caught up in the exercise of our own limited thing. But I hate to see my taxpayer money being wasted on something to me that was a charade to exonerate the governor of this state, and I think the governor of this state had made a colossal mistake in this Bridgegate, and he shows the same hubris that Mr. Trump has shown. Any comments on that, as well as the former mayor of the city of New York, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani?
Well, if you look at, I like to examine the facts. Giuliani was once upon a time called America's mayor. Superficially demonstrated on the outward level some special skills after 9/11. I never did examine them with rigid and exacting scrutiny, so maybe that title was earned. Nevertheless, his subsequent behavior, especially the last 2 or 3 years, suggests that he's undergone a major, major collapse of judgment and a super deterioration of character. Mr. Giuliani made a statement on Fox News that they had something coming that would hurt Hillary. Now we're finding out that he had been in cahoots with the FBI, that he had foreknowledge of what the director was going to do. It was coordinated, it was orchestrated, and Giuliani and other inside Republicans were given a heads up. Now, Giuliani has been disgraced, was my point. Governor Christie is a man with massive governmental skills, well-trained legal mind, can think on his feet, relatively articulative, can articulate, understand politics on a gut, basic level, a natural political with exceptional talent. But it's clear that every respectable political that jumps deep in the Donald Trump's pocket, it looks as if they subsequently, through the logic of events and the outward expression of events, end up looking as if they've been cursed. These are the facts. Both men have had a mighty fall since they attached themselves to Donald Trump. I think that assertion is unequivocal, and I don't think it can be challenged by anyone.
Let me ask you this, Brother Imam. You have again been around the bar, a member of the bar, in good standing, I'm sure, with the federal state bars. Do you think, with your legal mind, I want you to put your legal hat on now, is it possible that if Ms. Loretta K. Lynch is, as she's called, the general, attorney general, you think it's possible that Mr. Comey may be fired?
Let me say this. And I'm telling you, and I'm telling the audience, the last time I said some on this show and on another broadcast about these law enforcement people with all this power, I think I'm already experiencing some kind of subtle feedback. I have nothing to gain. It's not like millions in America are depending on me to make this a statement answering this question. I'm not going to make another statement publicly right now about the FBI. If you want to do it, you continue to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. As they say, we'll move on. Let's now turn our attention. And I understand and I appreciate that. I generally don't make statements about the Federal Bureau of Investigation. on my show. I stopped the brother from doing it, and may God protect me as I was raising the question. But you certainly are not obligated. And as they say in the law, strike that from the record, the question. I'm going to turn out
if people would, by implication, challenge President Obama. They see you who he's trying to support. They know who he wants to be president. Bill and Hillary Clinton are not slouches in terms of power in this system. Brother, we would be very naive and irrational given the line of defense and security that we have on a big oak tree full of limbs to be overly aggressive with this thing. If they would challenge old folks, a sitting president, a sitting vice president, and a couple as powerful as the Clintons, what do you think they'll do to us?
Yes, sir, I agree with you. I agree with you, and I'm sorry to go down that road, and I open the argument, Shaitan Regina. I seek refuge in the law and ask this for protection. Sometime, perhaps the political suicide, social suicide come out at me. So I'm going to withdraw that. I do agree with you.
We celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Panthers, and they had a term when people did unwise things. They call it adventurism. We don't have time to be in adventurous. We got responsibility. We have to survive. People need our leadership, okay? And we don't need to put this is not here. Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who was victimized by these matters in the 30s, ended up ultimately having to go to prison. He tried to school Malcolm because Malcolm, in his youthful zeal, had a little adventurism in it. So it's not fear, it's wisdom garnered from hard-earned experience. When I was a man, 19 years old, my husband was the University of Georgia, they had somebody on me 24/7. How do I know this? Because a man who was a co-eulogist at a funeral, one of my soldiers with me, he grew up with the guy, he told the whole audience. So they told us, the guy that was a Cecil named Five, to stay on Joe Sales and Five 24/7. Man, I ain't got time for these folks. Let's move on.
Yes, sir. Let's move out, turn our attention away from this and go right to the election. And let us, you give us analysis of the election. We, as much time as you need, to let's go to the battleground states and where you see this election going. I'm predicting Secretary Clinton to be the president-elect of the United States next week. A lawyer friend of mine told me we had a meeting, and he was saying, well, maybe we'll be on the way to Canada. I think whomever you, when you're listening to this broadcast, I know you're listening, I then advise you not to pack your bags. I think we'll see Secretary Clinton as the next president of the United States. So please give us your analysis.
There's no doubt. But see, people think these electoral college votes are like running up a score in some sport. Fans like to say we beat them in football 36-7. That really there's something added to a victory by running up the score. Now there's governmental and political implications later on by the extent of a victory. But when it comes to who's going to be the president, all I zero in is over 270. And I don't think there's anybody that would argue that Senator Clinton has over 270 electoral votes. One professional practitioner by the name of Larry Sabato did his analysis, and he had on the screen 272 hard. He said hard electoral vote. Now, it may be more than that, because North Carolina was not in the hard category. But with this Latino urge in this state court decision reversing all that voter suppression, and they said lines are wrapped everywhere in North Carolina today, it may fall. With the Latino surge in Florida, it may fall. With the Latino urge in super red state, Arizona, it may fall. With the Latino surge in Colorado, man, you get in some pockets of Colorado right there, and that little territory, if those Latinos turn out big time, there's nothing you can do with the state of Colorado. Same thing about Nevada. When that upsurge, that tide, exploded out of Nevada, that was a soft state. It'll fall. So how many does she need? Do we need to get up to 350, 400? When the test president of these United States is 270 electoral votes. Case closed.
Let me, even your home state of Georgia, let's even look at the South now, because I want to analyze those states. Georgia might possibly fall, isn't that right? And Secretary Clinton's
power. What I'm looking for now, let's go to your home state of Virginia. Used to be a red state. Obama has taken that state twice. I want you to follow me now.
Yes, sir.
The state is considered a harsh blue state and is not on the table. A month or so ago, Trump pulled his resources out of Virginia. You see a southern slide. This is my point. Obama won North Carolina the first time around in 2008. Barely lost it because Romney ran a heck of a campaign. I mean an excellent campaign in North Carolina. More likely it'll go blue. I'm looking for a slide further south with South Carolina in my home state of Georgia. If they don't fall this time, with Georgia maybe benefiting from skipping over South Carolina right now, it may go. But it's just a matter of time that southern slide out of your state changes demographics is going to carry the day all the way into Georgia. If not 2016, 2020, Alabama would be the Republican firewall to stop that southern western. Why? Because they passed the draconian laws and ran the Latinos out the state. So there's
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
What is the population of the African American in Alabama and in Georgia? And if we had 100% voting with even the suppression withstanding, if we had 99, if we were as fired up as the Latinos, though, we could almost clip those states to where we want to, couldn't we? And with a small coalition with the Caucasians or enlightened, we could change those two states, right?
Yeah, but it's not a small coalition in Georgia. You do take
I'm not saying in Georgia, but I'm asking you, the point I'm making is,
Of course,
I understand that. I understand that. What I'm asking you is, if African Americans in the state of Georgia would even maximize its voting population, the state could be flipped now. And I think even the I'm looking at the numbers. We have a high numbers in the state of Alabama. We have some counties that are about 90% African American.
You want me to deal with it? You want me to answer the question?
Please.
I think we should flip Georgia. That's because, like Philadelphia, they were talking about the fact that Philadelphia is going to turn in up to its machine, the last city machine in this state, in this country, is going to probably gin up 450,000 votes. No matter what happened in the other parts of the state, if that happens, the Democrats have taken that state. You got a similar situation. You don't have a machine, but in the metropolitan Atlanta area, there's large numbers of whites who will go against Trump. You don't have that in Alabama. I doubt if you get 10 to 15% whites, they're going to go against Trump in Alabama. So even if African America, which we did, we almost matched the turnout when Obama ran, especially the first time, and he nowhere near came close to taking Alabama. But yes, Georgia, if we did our thing in Georgia, we could take it right now.
Okay, all right, I got you. I'm asking you. I want you to now. Let's go to some of the other states, where it's kind of surprising that Mr. Trump has seemed to may lose the state of Arizona and possibly Utah. Will you discuss those states where a heavy Mormon population is?
He's going to lose, in my opinion, and again, all this is prediction. It's not prophecy. He's going to lose Utah, not to Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton, but to that independent candidate. He had a chance maybe of winning that state until this white nationalist made a tape attacking that Mormon candidate, attacking his mom, and suggesting that because he was 40 years old and was not married, that he was a homosexual. All that's going to do now is make every last Mormon in that state, in my opinion, vote for that independent Mormon candidate, even if some of them are planning to vote for Senator Clinton. She's not going to win, so it's not going to hurt her if they abandon her and go to McMullen, because what it does, it takes away electoral votes in a red state, and Trump needs every red state electoral vote he can get.
So his campaign is cratering, as it were.
Well, if he loses Georgia, Arizona, and Utah, he's in bad shape. That is a cratering. Losing three or four red states.
Let me ask you now about the United States Senate. And where does that portend for the Democrats taking the Senate? Will you discuss that with us?
2-3 weeks ago, the odds were heavy in their favor. They still may take it. But Mitch McConnell and Karl Rove saw the catastrophe coming. And so I noticed they went and somewhere conjured up $25 million of dog money. Don't nobody know where that dog money came from. Karl Rove, everybody know his slickness as an operative. And Majority Leader McConnell, they came up with that money overnight. I noticed ever since then, with that heavy infusion of cash, That's a lot of cash for 7-8 races. The races have been tightening to the point that it's hard to predict now that the Democrats will, as a certainty, retake the Senate.
So you're saying that we'll, okay, so it's a great possibility. What is Mr. Larry Sabato saying? And you all, let me just stop and make a station pause and make a commercial. You're listening to the Saturday edition of Religion Means Alive, a revised version of Live from Selma. We have with us Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam, who is not a political slouch. And again, I'm telling you, Allah is my witness, I can see us. I don't care what they say in Alabama and where they are in Alabama. I believe that Southern Caucasian will be flipped into outside in the next few years. I don't care what he's thinking. I think he will be flipped. But anyway, that's my prediction. Because I'm going to work like hell. I convinced three of them that made them bear doubt their own position. That's why I invite you to come to 710 West St. George Avenue in the city of Linden, where we will have our program. And it will be the men's program is at 1 o'clock. We need men in the streets. Men in action. We was going to form a group of called the Brotherhood of Islam. The Imam told us not to use that name, but to use another name, Muslim Men in Action. But this is not going to be Muslim Men in Action. It's going to be Men in Action, taking charge of our responsibility to our community. Come at 12:30 to help us work and set the place up. When church service is over, we're going to come into the Entrepreneur Business Center. And we're going to have a lecture from 1 to 3. Probably get the people out by 2:30. I expect to have Imam Mubashir Akhtar to be with us, Imam Kabir Shamsuddin, Brother Deep Shaka, Imam Deep Shaka. Many Christian preachers will be the warm-up. But I got an address to the African-American men. If other men come, they're welcome, but we didn't invite them. We did invite the African-American men to come to this meeting. 3 o'clock, we're going to shift gears, and we're going to host a major public address. This will again be at 710 West St. George Avenue, creating productive, safe, and strong communities. And we're going to broadcast live from 710 West St. George Avenue in the city of Linden. I think I would be derelict in my duties if I didn't invite the people of my hometown. I went on my block, invited all my neighbors to come out. This is your neighbor speaking. Come and hear us. We're going to go across these United States, and we're going to invite people into our same position. We believe that we have a position, and I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about us, that we've been given this message from God. When we will make a new al-Islam, new understanding that allows Christians, Muslims, and Jews to live in peace. Whether race, the ethnic group will live in peace. I'm not going to get your woman, and you don't need to get mine. Leave them alone. We ain't going to integrate the bedrooms. That's what I told the Southern Caucasian. I know you're worried about it. I know you're worried about Bubba taking your woman. I don't want your woman. I don't want you to have mine. So we're going to eventually, he's going to come on over. He's going to be the next 10 years, he'll be coming out saying, well, I ain't no Muslim, but I damn sure like Imam Alfred or someone else just like us. And we have to be convinced of that. We're never going to win unless we believe we're going to win. So y'all come out creating productive, safe, and strong communities, 710 West St. George Avenue in the city of Linden. And we're going to hold these meetings around the whole region. Until the cows come home, and the cows come home, symbolic of social order will come in our hand. God is willing to give it to us. All we got to do is claim it. It ain't going to come by magic. It ain't going to come by sitting down. It ain't going to come by complaining. It's not going to come by moaning. It's going to come by work. I'm way over 50 years of age, but I work today just like I was 18, knocking on doors and inviting people to come to 710 West St. George's Avenue in the city of Linden, New Jersey. And very soon, we're going to be coming to a town near you. sister, you told me 2 years ago, said, Brother Ma'am, you've been on the radio. It's time to take it to the neighborhood. Well, sister, I answered you. I prayed, and I'm getting a few brothers to help me. And we apologize that we were not on the air yesterday. But we're without help. You all want to volunteer and help us in this ministry, write me, ma'amalfred@gmail.com, or come out to the meeting and tell me what kind of work you want to do. Let's go into these neighborhoods and put human beings into these bodies. Let's de-niggerize our community. Let's de-coonize our community. Let's make human beings in our community. I want to now take a walk, Brother Ma'am, and excuse me for that commercial. I want you to now take us to the United States House of Representatives and go to Speaker Ryan and whether his position is shaky and where you see the United States House of Representatives.
Obviously, if the Democrats cannot retake the Senate, struggling with that, there's no way they're going to take the House. We can take that off the table right now. But you never can tell. Maybe some of those heavily contested races in these Latino districts, maybe they could flip some, but not, I don't think, the number that's needed. Steve Bannon, one of Trump's dark magicians, got a thing on for Paul Ryan, Speaker Ryan. If Donald Trump wins the presidency, I'm almost 99.9% sure that Speaker Ryan is a donor. But even if Trump does not win, through Breitbart and social media and all these other things, Steve Bannon gonna try to instigate Ryan's removal through those faulty primitives called the Freedom Caucus in the House. And they ran Boehner away. And if they don't run Speaker Ryan away through the instigation of Steve Bannon, I will be shocked.
So you would say that the Speaker should watch his back. But I think if Mr. Trump is defeated, I think that the party, well, let's talk about the state of the Republican Party now.
It's splintered. And the forces behind Trump are not going away because he loses. They can create a very strong apparatus to do what you call primary those House people who go against their little power base. And they can put pressure not only on the members of that Freedom Caucus, that fought us, so I think, but on all the Shaker House members, because it's not like our politicians stand on any principles now. The main goal is to survive an election. So I'm not saying that Speaker Ryan is gone, but he may have to pack his bag.
So you would urge the Speaker to get some suitcases. What do you think is going to happen in the Republican Party, the party now, if they are defeated? Now, assuming that they are defeated, what do you think is going to happen?
They are going to be splintered, and they are going to be angry, because they did an autopsy after the last election. And the report came back saying, we got to expand the tent. And they're going to study these results. And they're going to see that in an election year where possibly Senator Clinton could have been taken,
they blew it by not following through on that report, and a large Latino vote, a strong African-American vote, a strong Asian-American vote, a strong single women vote, wiped them out. And that's going to create tension, discord, and disharmony. Secondarily, the fact that they could not preclude an individual like Trump from getting the nomination is also going to have long-term vital fallout that make it very difficult for this party to unite in anywhere near what one would call strength.
So are you predicting a funeral of the Republican Party? Or are you predicting a wounding of the Republican Party? What are you predicting in terms of the party now that probably November the 6th, 7th, will be the dark days for the Republican Party, right?
I'm predicting a very acute illness, and if they don't, that's short term, but acute, and if they don't watch it, it can transmute into a chronic, insidious, slow slide to the death bed.
Let me ask you, do you think the, in some districts, it's kind of, I don't know what Mr. Salvatore, he's probably one of the most reliable. It seems that the Democrats will pick up some seats, so the Republicans may be in some disarray, wouldn't they?
They may pick up some House seats, yeah, but they need over 30, I think.
But they won't detain 30, but they might obtain 10, right? There are several. I haven't been following the congressional races lately. What's your take on the Republican on the races?
The issue is always takeover, especially in the House. You gain 10, you still maybe 20 now. So, I mean, really. But the Cook Report is a good report, too. And I don't
think what the Cook Report is saying. I made an opportunity. Y'all working me so hard, and I have to put bread on the table. I made a giant study of the Cook Report. The Cook Report is an excellent report.
I think he's predicting tightness in the Senate and none take over the House, but he has projected Senator Clinton with more than enough votes to win the election.
What is he predicting for the House? His report is usually bird.
He's not predicting us to take over.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so. But she's having a comfortable lead. He's predicting. What is he saying about the race in Illinois for the United States Senate and also in Wisconsin?
I don't recall specifically, but everybody knows probably that the race in Illinois is over, that Kirk will probably lose his seat. Now, from what I've been picking up, Feingold has had a substantial lead throughout this race until the last week, and now Johnson is nipping at his heels. And I think a lot of that has to do with that heavy infusion of dog money.
Mm-hmm. So Karl Rove, them are not trying to save Mr. Trump. Mr. Rove, if I'm understanding correctly, is trying to save the Republican conservative brand.
He's trying to say it was not just Rove, it was the majority leader, Mitch McConnell as well. They worked in tandem. They thought that the Senate was gone, and so they made a desperation move.
Well, now, Mr. McConnell, senator, that is, isn't he from the state of Alabama originally before he went to Kentucky? And isn't he the one that said we're going to break the president? And isn't he the one that hasn't broken the president? I wonder how he's feeling now. Is he stayed, well, I shouldn't talk to him, but I don't want to get you or I in trouble. And he stayed with his Asian wife, and I've done wrong with that. But I find these people to be a living contradiction when I talk to these Southern Caucasians about them. You know what? I'm telling you, brother, Imam, I'm saying that I ain't cocky. I'm pretty confident. I have that much trust in Imam Muhammad. I believe we can win the American people over to our views. I'm not talking about making them Muslim, but bringing them to a centered politics. I want you to make a comment on that. I believe that there's going to be a new coalition that's going to be against empire, that's going to be against, and I'm not here to bash homosexuals. I want you to know I ain't here just for one sin. And I'm not even talking about love wins. But I believe that there are people in America who just are tired of cultural norms being thrown away and thrown down our throat, pro-abortion, a lot of the stuff that has come from the left wing of the Democratic Party in the left period. Just been shoved down our throats. I think there are Mormons. I think there are good evangelical Christians. I know that there are good Muslims. And there are people who just want traditional value. And I think they offer an opportunity for I'm not talking about the leaders. I am not talking about the deceptive leaders. And I told this Caucasian Southerner on the train ride, I'm not talking about your leaders. I know your leaders. I grew up with some of your leaders, and I know that they don't have your interests at heart. I told him that straight up. He listened. I said, you know, I know you. You and I grew up together, so I know you. I'm a Southern. I was born and raised here. I've been here. My name is Muhammad, and I've been here maybe before. You say you've probably been here before I've been here. I said, you're right. I came here in 1619 and even before, and I said I was forced here. But I'm happy to be here. I think we got to talk to them with that kind of conviction and let them know who the new boss is in a very subtle way. I'm going to shut up because I'm fired up. I am yet talked to the Caucasians of Linden. I'm not yet ready to talk to them till I can clean our neighborhood. Thank you.
Well, the position you staked out, I don't have to commented on it and extensively because you would have to acknowledge that's basically the position that Imam Muhammad took. Certain historical circumstances have emerged, but they are not insurmountable in terms of preventing that basic strategic position and analysis. But back to McConnell. We can talk about McConnell. One thing about intelligence, it gives one the ability to discriminate. I said I didn't want to talk about the FBI. Ms. McConnell is in a whole nother bag. Ms. McConnell can't have a truck parked outside of my house doohickeying with the wives and things. Okay, so that's a different situation. I'm saying that to say, don't think my caution in regard to this powerful law enforcement branch is an across-the-board position.
Imam, I understand that. I also understand that you are certainly a very wise man, and I just wanted to just interrupt to say that what I read at first, I didn't know you. Until I read, we had worked together, but until I read of you in the Wall Street, in the Christian Science Monitor, and I said to my son then, before I met you, he was young, I said, now here's a man that makes me want to leave the pulpit and come out and run for office. I said, because he is, when they talked about you in that restaurant, talking to a Caucasian about some of the business of being an Alabamian and not by race and drunk on race. I said, man, this is a man we can make some hay with. And they all blessed us to meet. And we met through a Southerner, another Southerner that came out of Georgia, your home state. That's a lot. So I don't want anybody in this audience to ever think I doubt your political acumen. your spirituality and your wisdom and your courageousness.
Let me say something about that. The position that you're taking, that you articulated on a miniature level, that's what was utilized in Selma. And it worked. But alert people have to always be flexible enough to deal with unforeseen circumstances. Now, the election of President Barack Hussein Obama changed attitudes of some of these folks in Selma. The candidacy of Donald Trump, that was a lot of working together in Selma. That person not going to be willing in Selma to just easily now work with whites who's supporting a man that's been endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan. We got to be real. Now, so I'm not saying that we cannot get back to that other stage, but there has been intervening variables that we have to acknowledge and adjust to and wait until Allah dissipate them and open up the door again. It's not completely closed. But if I'm in a situation in Selma now, I go on the radio every Wednesday. I'm going to tell other people not to vote for Donald Trump. I'm going to talk about his supporters. Even though I know all my white friends listening, and most of them support Trump. But I tell them and I tell African Americans, there's no permanent friends, there's no permanent enemies, there's only permanent interests. And my interest is to stand against any human being that is unfair to any group among the sons and daughters of Adam. And not just stand, but to stand with all the might I have. Now, so my position, okay, if you're a Trump lover, I'm a Trump basher. And I'm going to bash him until the election is over. But after election, dear beloved brother, maybe we can go back to the downtown, eat some eggs and grits, and drink a cup of coffee.
Yes, sir.
We're not going to be in a superficial thing as if we got a certain kind of unity in the government, and your interest is toward Trump, and my interest is toward kicking Trump butt. That's the bottom line. The two can't join there. Now, once this election is over, and maybe we can come back to common entry, because it's not based upon animosity, it's based upon interest. Okay? So I just want to add that little tweak to what you're saying. But in the long run, yes, I believe that we're going to be able to do exactly what you said. But some temporary funding blocks out there.
I want to turn our attention just a moment to the internal politics of our community, because I think that God says that he's raised up a community out of the community, the broad community of Islam, to enjoin the right and to forbid the wrong. And it seems to me that we have had a real, real slumber, that people are sleeping on the cargo in the community of Imam Deputy Muhammad. I don't know whether you, maybe you were bad weekend with the Muslim African Americans. I don't know whether you were there and with the so-called leaders of Imam Muhammad's community this weekend. I don't know whether you were there or not. I certainly wasn't there, and I was not interested in being there. Why is it that the community of Imam Deputy Muhammad's leadership seem to be sleeping on the cargo, snoring on the cargo, perhaps some dead on the cargo and also killing others. What's your explanation? I like to always start home.
Let me go to a situation of a Juma that I'm aware of. There's two parts to Juma, and I'm not an Islamic scholar, but it's my understanding that the first part of the Kufar, and if I'm wrong, you correct me, you're more learned and more conversant in the deen than I am, so, and I'm humble enough to listen. The first part is given to spiritual instruction, but the second half, my understanding, it's appropriate to raise community concerns. But I like to use the term concern in the environment, because community concerns can be limited to a little petty stuff within the internal dynamics of the message. And it has nothing to do with the overall environment. Now, Muhammad had to address the overall environment in Medina when he gave the kufar. He couldn't ignore certain battles coming up at the Juma. He had to be, now our environment is a lot bigger and global now, so our attention should be toward a global environment. And let me drive my point on home. I don't see how in the world with Canada saying that its goal is to ban all Muslims from America, to go up in the masjid and survey them with, again, our interest. We have an interest to keep our masjid open and free from intimidation. That's a permanent interest. Okay, so how can you have a Juma the Friday before the election and don't take one sinner to tell your people to go out and vote, cry and shame? That happened in a big mess here. I'm not talking about a small mess here. That's not just sleeping. That's darn near being dead from the leadership on down.
You would pride maybe a few homicide cases. It would seem to me analogizing on a spiritual level that perhaps that these people willfully, or certainly negligently, and possibly criminally neglected their duties.
Using a little rhetorical hyperbole, because we know that it was not technically a crime in the sense that it violated, maybe did some Quranic provision, but certainly not American law. But in a metaphorical sense, to me that was a crime. There's
Share with you something that I'm quoting that I'm not exactly quoting, Imam Muhammad. He said, "What's wrong with you Muslim imams who don't go to work on our people?" He said, if you go to a hospital, this is Imam Muhammad, and a man, you giving surgery to a man that maybe needs an aspirin, and you neglect to take care of that man that's in need, he said, that man, that person could be murdered on the spot. This is Imam Muhammad. That may be hyperbole. If you see a wolf coming into a house, and you were telling people about the life after death, and that wolf could eat up the innocent children. If that were a court of law, what would probably happen to you? You probably talk criminal procedure. I know you've talked torts. What would happen to you?
Well, that's a blatant example of leadership neglect. And we know a shepherd has certain responsibilities. And I think that duty, that fiduciary duty to the people in that context is a severe violation. Look, if a man can get up there and go through all this meandering, kufa-like
You just so spellbinding the people with Arabic, but they can't take a minute to get to the love people, get out and vote on Tuesday. Something wrong with that. Something wrong with that.
Yes, there's something drastically wrong with that. I think I have an idea where you were, and I don't want to hint where you were. I don't want to look at your travel plan. But I tell you something. I think these major messages, I haven't heard them say anything. Well, let me ask you this. Two final questions. Aren't some of these the same people, when Imam Muhammad was living, he asked us to give a picture in America of Christian Muslims working together? Perhaps they're continuing a pattern in America of not showing up. I don't think Mr. Trump would have risen in America if we had given the correct picture of Al-Islam as taught by Imam Waqif Muhammad. I just don't believe it.
I say amen to that, because there would have been aggressive human forces that would counteract this kind of rise. No doubt about it. I was present when the Imam established the Coalition for Good Government. Majid in North Carolina, I think, was present.
Mm-hmm.
You brought team out of Tennessee and a couple of brothers out of New Jersey. It's absolutely no excuse. With the common knowledge of the Coalition for Good Government that the politicians then established, you know the Imam recommended that. So if we're urged to have enough civic awareness to form a Coalition for Good Government with all Americans, you mean to tell me just that suggestion doesn't raise an irrebuttable presumption that we have a duty to, a civic duty to vote, and that our leadership has an obligation inherent in that leadership to make sure we vote?
What about the New World Patriotism Day that is dormant? Well, the only leader I know right now is promoting New World Patriotism Day is Imam Waqif Muhammad II. I think if we walk down the main drag down Atlanta, the main drag in Birmingham, the main drag in these main big cities, and we had shown the picture that here is the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, a man who was justified in not being patriotic to America, seeing his fellow citizens lynched. But yet this son picks up the American flag, not as some Uncle Tom, but as a New World Patriot. You think if that message had come out to the American people, we would be where we are now?
Yes, I can prove it. Because one of the things that lifted me up in Selma was that everybody understood that I was an a bastion, certainly unequivocal patriot. And I stood upon this democratic order and great republic. Now, where did I get that from? Imam Waqif Muhammad. I remember when he picked up that flag in Gary. That was the first time I was almost tempted to leave his leadership. Ignorant, did not understand. But riding back to where I needed to go, I thought about it, and I said, Imam Muhammad is my leader, and I'm going to follow him. And because I followed him, that paid dividends when I went into politics itself. I'm a patriot, one given to the ways of the, we're not patriarchs given to rigid hierarchical governmental and religious organization. Too many of our imams are patriots, giving themselves to an ego urge to be a part of the priesthood hierarchy. And that's killing us. We don't need any fathers. But Muhammad was not the father of any of us. He was the prophet of God and the seal of the prophet. So a lot of these brothers need to stop running around trying to be our daddy. That's enough of
sounds
that.
Sounds to me,
man,
that they have been heavily influenced by dead Islam rather than alive Islam. Is that right?
Well, the thing speaks for itself. It's 1:39, and you pressing me to get out a big belt that I don't necessarily want to do, but I done started unbuckling it. And if one or two more questions like that, I'll be swinging a big belt on this religion means alive. So let's.
I just want you to help wake the dead up. I'm not going to hold you, brother, man. We've held you long, but you have been so eloquent that it's like a cow. You are not a farm boy like I am, so I used to milk cows. You know, when the cow's milk would start coming out, you kept on milking it because you were so eloquent and so beautifully, and I think people should tell people to listen to this program. I think when we listen to the program, that we will get more out of it, and we will understand. And I'm going to say this in closing, that I, too, was like Imam Muhammad. I didn't understand what he said all the time, but I had faith. See, a lot of these people say they are students of Imam Muhammad, but I was first a follower and still am a follower. There's some things he said 30 years. Some of these things he said to me 38 years ago, personally, I'm talking about personally, have now I finally understand. And now people used to say this song. Sing this song. We'll understand it by and by, by and by. And I will say that you have to first have faith that Almighty God has blessed us as a people. And consequently, we should serve as a blessing to all people. And I believe that we have an obligation first to the people that we came from, and then we have an obligation to the American people that we live among. That is Christians, Muslims, Jews, and others. Because I know our Buddhist friends, I know our Hindu friends, I know our people who may not have any faith at all need a witness in this very, very difficult time. I want you to give us a closing statement. We're going to let you go home to your family and enjoy a great meal. And I hope you'll remember us in your prayers tomorrow, and that we may have a packed out, and Allah will bless us to say something to the people that will guide them to understanding the truth. Thank you.
Let me just say our duty, dear beloved audience, coming from a history where people tried to decivilize us, but the light of civilization is amongst us now. And there's a relationship between being civilized and being civic oriented. Our ancestors literally bled so we would have the right to vote. We ask Almighty God to have mercy and to inspire us to go out and be civilizers and teach civilization by demonstrating a massive act of civility, by respecting the blood-stained banners of our ancestors, and get out and vote for the candidate of your choice. As Imam, I have made my choice clear. But let there be no coercion in the exercise of human choice. Your choice is your choice, but the obligation to vote is all of our choice.
our obligation and our duty and our civic responsibility. Brother Imam, it's been a joy. It's been a blessing.
Next time we speak, I think you will have your choice of your candidate would be the president-elect of these United States.
I might not have a chance to even look. I'll be working so hard while it's still light and still.
We are open after the election to go to Selma, Alabama, and address the public of Selma. And you are invited to come to the great city of Linden and other cities and travel with us. Let us travel throughout these United States and wake our people up. And then let our people wake up all people and bring them to all that is good. We'll see you tomorrow all on Religion Means Alive. We will be broadcasting live from 710 West St. George Avenue in the great city of Linden, New Jersey. Set your GPS to 710 West St. George Avenue. And we'll see you.
Sir.
Thank you, Brother Imam. And apologize, Imam Mubashir Akhtar, for the program yesterday. It was not an oversight on our part. It was a technical problem. But he will be on the air Monday. He'll be on the air Tuesday. He'll be on the air Thursday. He'll be on the air Friday. We will return next Saturday live from Selma, we're going to call it. You all tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell everybody to listen to Religion Means Alive. It's the most happening show in America. And we're going to tick this with your support. I'm getting some solid business people who tell us they're going to come into the table to help support it. We're going to take it from the blog to mainstream radio on to television. And we're going to bring America back, make America an alive nation that is going to fulfill its promise that it made to God. Thank you. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive.